Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic. It's always fantastic to have you all here as we kick into the end of January 2017 with our recording sessions. And we've got a great episode coming up for you, so stand by for that. But if I could talk, I would be able to introduce my co-host, Sam Bradley.
That's all right, Jamie. My teeth are chattering. I'm sitting here with my electric blanket in my lap. It's about 19 degrees where I am. And if I just had a cat and some knitting, I'd have the complete profile. But I'll get used to this someday. So we got a great show going on tonight, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, we got our meteorologist, Kyle Nelson, who is up in Aspen. And I think it's cold here. It's what, about 3 degrees up there, Kyle?
Hey, good evening, Sam, and everyone on the podcast. Just dropped to 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh. That's plus two. And standing out here at the top of the Big Air at Winter X Games in Aspen, Colorado. I'm doing the ski patrol thing tonight, working athlete medical. So happy to jump in the podcast here for a little bit.
I just wish we had some pictures of where you are. That would be extremely cool. I'm trying to get a visual on that. But just so I know you're busy and you got to go run off and do your thing, but if you can give us a quick weather update. And there was some tornado activity that was pretty serious recently, if you could touch on that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll start with the tornadoes right away. So January 21 through 23, so far, at least 62 tornadoes have been confirmed by National Weather Service storm surveys across the southeast. So it was a pretty widespread event across several days, and at least 20 deaths have been confirmed so far. But unfortunately, I think we're going to see more once the searches continue into some of the more remote areas there in the southeast United States. The majority of those tornadoes, or at least a fair bit of them, did occur in the evening hours. So that may have contributed to some of the higher number of deaths and things. But also, it just goes back to, you know, having a plan and being aware of the weather that's going on and that's forecast for your area, and just having multiple ways to receive that weather information and those weather warnings and alerts if they should be issued. Over in the European theater, heavy snow and earthquakes in the mountains of Italy actually contributed to avalanches, one of which impacted a hotel up there in the mountains. And the rescue effort there was absolutely heroic. And fortunately, many survivors tell stories of surviving by, you know, eating snow and finding ways to, you know, melt it to stay alive until rescuers could reach them. So it's been a pretty interesting start to 2017 here for weather-related disasters and such things. But thankfully, across the U.S., we're in a little bit of a quiet period here for the next few days, so we're looking forward to that.
Well, thanks, Kyle. That's just kind of mind-blowing already, what's going on. So we appreciate that. We love your updates, and we'll let you run off and play with your mountain and your X Games, and stay warm and safe up there.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So, Dr. Joe Hawley, what do you think about all of that? You're down there in Memphis, but so you wouldn't have been affected by that. But that's kind of scary to think all those tornadoes are kicking up. And with that death rate already, we usually don't see that all year.
Yeah, you know, those were obviously quite severe weather outbreaks down there. And something fairly unusual happened, and that is FEMA put my task force and one other task force and one incident support team on alert for a tornado outbreak, which to my memory is unprecedented. We did not get any requests for, to actually go, but we were packed up and ready to get on the road should a call come. So that's pretty unusual for a tornado outbreak, just because they're so unpredictable and tend to be fairly, you know, localized, so the local resources can take care of them. But we were on alert there for about 36 hours.
Wow. I guess the assumption is if you got that many going on, that your resources are going to be pretty spread pretty thin.
I think so, and I think it was a little bit unusual that we actually got placed on alert probably 7 or 8 hours before they were even scheduled to hit. So I think that says a lot about the prediction capability now and the confidence that those guys like Kyle and others have with their equipment and their tools and their education.
Well, and I think it's good for our listeners to know that, you know, that's out there. That USARS, that's federal government's watching what's going on, and they have USARS and DMATs that they could stage, just like they stage tend to stage DMATs more in terms of hurricanes and so forth. But the fact that they had you guys stage for these tornadoes lets people know they're putting resources in place in a worst case scenario. So it's good for folks to know that.
Absolutely.
All right. We have a really fun podcast tonight. We have a great guest, the disaster doc. And of course, we have Joe Hawley, who's a disaster doc. And it should be no huge surprise that the two of them know each other. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But I think I hooked up with Dr. Mark Keim on LinkedIn and started watching what he was doing. And this guy does a lot of stuff. He's the founder of Disaster Doc. It's an international consultant and education firm dedicated to helping people to protect themselves from disaster. He's on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. He's a prolific author. He's even worked on the White House Subcommittee for Disaster Reduction and has gotten awards for his work. So we're pretty proud to have him here. So, Joe, you and Dr. Mark even worked on a project together, didn't you?
We did indeed. And welcome, Mark. It's great to talk to you again. It's been a long time since we had a chance to share a conversation. Mark and I talked together on earthquake preparedness for the Central U.S. Earthquake Consortium several years back.
That just sounds like great fun. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes, that's right, Joe. And thanks so much. It's a pleasure to work with Joe again. That was those were good days. I think it was a lot of good work done in the Central United States Earthquake Consortium, still doing a lot of good work as well. So I look forward to us all having a reunion in the future sometime.
Well, it's bound to happen. That's just how things work in our circles. And you both are very much in education. Joe, of course, with Paragon Medical Education, but it's a very different kind of education. And Jamie, this is a couple good topics we're going to discuss here that are really good for you to jump into because it also involves medical, nursing education, and public health response. So, you know, feel free to jump in there. So, Mark, is there anything else that you want to tell us about yourself that I may not have touched on?
Well, it's actually quite symbolic that you talk about tornadoes during the podcast here. Actually, I became interested in tornadoes rather abruptly at 3:16 p.m. on May 29th in 1982, and that's when my family were struck by the Marion, Illinois tornado in F4, which destroyed 1,500 homes in a city of about 30,000 people in Marion, Illinois.
Wow.
So that period of time, I was homeless. I was one of those families that were rendered homeless at the time. Luckily, no one in my family was injured at the time. But actually, what I attribute to saving my life was education. I had 15 years prior to that, at 7 years old, my mother we never had much money when I was growing up, but my mom always had a soft touch for buying me books. And so I convinced my mom to purchase a book in the back of a newsletter that we called at the time Weekly Reader. Maybe some of your listeners actually remember the old Weekly Reader newsletter that we got when we were in grade school.
I remember.
And there you go.
I thought you would, Joe.
That tells our age as well, doesn't it?
I wasn't going to say that.
It does.
But there was an example where here as a little boy, 7 years old, I'm interested in reading about these disasters and what do you do, how they act, which way do they go, how fast, how big, and so on. And there were two separate times, I won't go into a lot of detail and take up a lot of time, but there were two separate times during that event, that life-threatening event for me and my family, where I had to make two separate decisions. The first one was wrong and had to make another one. And what I attribute to saving my life was reading a book when I was 7 years old, probably a $2 book. So I'm a big believer in education, and especially when we're talking about disaster-related education.
So would it be safe to say that that experience might have had something to do with where your career evolved to where you are now?
Oh, Absolutely. So, you know, there, when that happened, I was actually in pre-med, trying to get into medical school. And I had to drop out of school. I started my own business for 5 years and got myself back into medical school. So I knew the hardships of disaster survivors, not only when you're back in your home, but living on for 5 years after that. It took me back to get into college. And then while in college, I became interested in disaster epidemiology, started watching some of the work that people like Scott Lillibridge and Eric Noge and Gil Burnham, Skip Burkle were writing. And I just became more and more interested in these gracious mentors that we have actually continue to give me good advice. And to this day, my wife and I both seriously say the best thing that ever happened to us was a tornado mm-hmm. and the disaster, surviving that.
Well, I haven't heard anybody say that, but I can appreciate where you're coming from. I definitely want to talk more about your business and what you do and get your resource information out there. But I want to jump into these questions. You came up with three really interesting topics, the first of which is professionalism of disaster, medical, nursing, and public health response. Do you want to start with that, Mark? And then Joe and Jamie can jump in.
I'd be happy to. I'll just sort of, you know, explain what I mean by that, and then I'd love to hear Joe and Jamie his input on this. You know, basically, there's been, of course, this trend, especially over the past decade now, for the calling for the need for professionalization of disaster medicine, nursing, and public health interventions. And people for many years took the idea to, and you know, I can't blame them, that you know, you get what you can in a disaster. What do you expect is a disaster? But over time now, in many of these fields, and even including emergency management in general, we're actually seeing these fields become more professionalized. You know, war is a chaotic event. The fog of war is very well documented throughout history, but yet there is a professionalization of the role of the soldier and systems that go on day after day that build that system and preference. And I were to say, in our war of disasters, that we lack that professionalization, that commonality, where some people have a permanent job in a professional job and a career in disaster medicine, in disaster nursing, and public health. And in particular, that science itself, those fields carry on as compared to where we've been struggling over the past decade of transitioning from what used to be things that people did, on a temporary basis, getting federalized and going out and doing these responses and then going home and, you know, picking up their lives again, catching up with family, catching up with work and so on. So that's sort of what I'm talking about, this overall trend. We did see a big outlash against what were seen as unnecessary amputations that unqualified people with the best intentions, of course, going into Haiti performed, that many of them were actually unnecessary and life-threatening. We've also seen the same kind of phenomenon occurring in Typhoon Haiyan in Philippines and also Indonesia earthquake, where inappropriate resources were sent. And my call is the professionalization that actually, just like our fire department started out to be, our mail, all these things started out to be sort of professional and ad hoc. We professionalize these things now, and we depend upon them. In major cities, we don't call upon people who have no fire experience to put out the complex, suppress the complex fires and the complex environments that we have in cities. Why should we do so with health? And that's where I stand out. I'll leave that to pass that over to you, Joe.
And Joe, you know, on the subject of amputations, we're having a sideline discussion because I put one in the new book that I'm writing, and Joe helped me do that because you've actually done that. But of course, you are a professional. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think Mark is absolutely on target. You know, as I was listening to him and thinking about it, as he talked sort of mostly about the issues related to response, I could certainly see where someone who had dedicated their career to disaster management, for lack of a better term, and I use that very generically, would also be spending a fair amount of time in prevention and mitigation and preparation and all those other things that we tend not to spend an awful lot of time on. As he said, people go back to their lives and off they go. And, you know, we have a lot of good intentions to prepare better the next time, but we never really get around to it. And I think that the folks that have made those responses would be the best people to spearhead preparation efforts and planning and staging and all of those kind of things, because they've been there, they know what the issues are going to be, and they are very real to those people, as opposed to folks who have never been through it and sort of tend to pencil whip it or simply don't understand. They don't know what they don't know in those situations, I guess.
Oh, well said. So, Jamie, you are a professional educator. You devote your entire life through podcasts and other things to many levels of education. You know, you're saying disaster, paramedic level. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm struck by the just thinking about, you know, from a nursing aspect of things, how many nurses, especially in the public health sector, are kind of in that area where they could be doing more to become professionally educated about disasters and response. You know, so often our public health professionals are overlooked as a resource in the face of disaster until it happens, and then they're kind of thrown into it. And different areas are more prepared than others, but I could see definitely an opportunity for this type of education and continuing training to help nurses in that field and in other fields like emergency departments and things like that be better prepared for when these types of situations occur in their communities.
And Mark, this kind of segues into your second subject, which is career ladders in disaster-related health fields. Do you think there needs to be more degree programs and more disaster-focused programs out there? And I think that leads into that concept of career ladders. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, there have been some nice articles over the past few years that have described the disaster-related training opportunities and the certifications that are out there, whether they're associated with particularly focusing on health, whether it be a disaster medicine, public health, or even core competencies. Some of those will come out of Columbia. Another disaster specialist, David Bratt, has also written on that as well. And his overall appraisal of many of these training programs, you know, they're creating the training without the career ladder. And so in many cases, people can have a great opportunity to take bits and pieces of these trainings. And many of the times the trainings appear, according to his appraisal, in my own recent project and work with the World Health Organization looking at the same issue. We found that, you know, there's a lot of training out there. Sometimes it's overlapping. There are huge gaps in those trainings. But what people are really missing is how you get that into your career. You know, you may have a fundamental area of interest in your job, or, for example, in many cases, it's particularly in medicine, EMS, and nursing. You know, these are things that we do above and beyond the call of duty, so to speak, that these are areas of interest. Many times these are volunteers, or it's something that's unexpectedly dropped in our lap. So once again, this low probability events are difficult to train for, difficult to maintain a high level of competency. And what I was alluding to earlier is that we do require a high level of competency in many of these events. And I would sort of characterize where we stand, particularly in the United States, as rather than having an overall arching pervasive level of high level of competency, I think we've done a great job over the past 15 to 20 years to get a pervasive level of awareness. I think it's, you know, especially in the United States post 911, a lot of public health, EMS, nursing doctors are talking together about disasters that have never talked and worked together before. So I think that that's a really great baseline capability. But I think also what we're lacking is this oversight, this disaster medical and disaster nursing, disaster EMS competency of oversight and organizational structure where you have leadership in these institutions. And so that all of EMS is linking together with all of public health, all of emergency medicine. For example, I would say here we have a good practical example here. You know, the work that Joe is doing, I would call, you know, one of those typical kinds of pockets of excellence where you have highly qualified people who have really have done these types of technical procedures in the field and know when they're qualified, when these amputations are necessary, and so on. Those are the kinds of people that should be overseeing larger organizational and institutional efforts, not just within the government, but also on a private scale, and be institutionalized in, so that larger numbers of people have the advantage of Joe's knowledge and his experience. Not everyone throughout all 50 states in the United States is going to be able to experience a number of disasters sufficient enough to actually get what I would consider an adequate education. And to close with my own example, when I first started at CDC, that was one of the things I was faced with. I was working in my first job in CDC years ago, wet behind the ears. I was working for only domestic disasters. And we were doing responses, many of them of all different sizes, but major responses in the United States, maybe two, maybe three major disasters, if that. And I started looking at the calculations of what a 20-year career would be and realizing that if I'm going to be a disaster expert, I need an N of more than, a few a year. So I branched out, did more international work just for the fact of being able to have a larger number of disasters under my belt. And I think, Joe, people that are in QSEC that focus on certain other specific hazards, there are other people that focus on hurricanes and so on that are experts in many different areas, earthquakes and so on. I think that's the kind of leadership that needs to be pulled together at the national level. And finally, the logical place for that to occur has already been identified by Congress as the National Center for Disaster Medicine and Public Health. The issue is that Congress never followed through to fund that organization to develop these kinds of professional guidelines, to fund organizations at the state and local level like your good work that you're doing, getting the education out there.
You know, Mark, wow. I have a question, because one of the challenges, and you touched on this, is the infrequency of the disasters. And we talk about this on the show here all the time, that we're talking to people about preparing for sometimes that once in a career event. And so the challenge comes in, how do you move effectively from, as a responder or as a person who wants to be a leader in this field, from that awareness level or maybe low-level operational training to becoming that expert?
Absolutely. You've hit the crux of the question right there. And actually even alludes to my third point as well, is that I think what we need is we have to have an organizational structure. First, a recognition that there are different levels of learning that you're talking about, right? You know, you mentioned it there, awareness level, that's the basics. And in my recent, I did a 6-month study with the World Health Organization in Geneva looking at international emergencies, global health emergency management decisions throughout the entire world, interviewed people, did a literature review and so on. And what we're really lacking in that aspect is identifying really what are people really doing in the field. And you know, when we look at that in business, I think, Joe, actually, since I saw you last, I completed an MBA at Emory University. And one of the things that was really important in business, when you start talking about what your employees are going to do and how efficient your line is and production or services or whatever, is you analyze the tasks that they perform. You actually go and you watch them. So you perform what's called a task analysis. When was the last time that anyone bothered to do that? I mean, I understand, of course, these are busy disasters, but we don't do that for disaster managers. We don't do that for disaster responders, where we have someone's job is to actually analyze these tasks. And then the next step of this competency-based education model is to identify the competencies that are required to perform those tasks you've actually performed. And in my experience of, 20 years of this, it's surprising the kinds of tasks we really do compared to the ones when we sit in committee, and I'm guilty of this as well. I don't know about you, Jamie or Joe or Sam, but I've sat in committee. These are the kinds of things I think disaster medical people need to know. And then I did a task analysis and I found out, that the things that they really need to know that they didn't know were things like how to use a satellite phone, how to get on a conference call, how to mute your phone, how to get inside a here's a good one, how to get inside a exit and enter a helicopter in a safe way. You know, those kinds of things. Of course, we have the other scientific things, but this idea of tasks and then competencies and then learning objectives that identify those competencies, and then a set of performance indicators that let your employer know and let your teacher know that when you perform that action, you're competent. So I think that's an important step that we need to address when we're talking about this professionalization of disasters. We really do need to define what is the role, and that needs to be done. I think this goes full circle to the beginning of the discussion here when you were talking, Joe, about and also I think you alluded to it way as well, Jamie, that you know really doing the job. I think it's very practical. That's one of the good things I think came that from me coming out of the background of emergency medicine and EMS and really being field-based and disaster medical response-based before I did public health was that it really has to be where the rubber meets the road. And so these performance indicators really do have to show that we have people that are competent and have a career ladder that when you take that first course in public health or in EMS, that should build towards a career. Later, somewhere down the line, there should be intermediate level and advanced level competencies. And finally, just to close, I know I'm chattering on here a lot, but just to close also, I think we also have to recognize that there are tiered levels of learning that not only just you have what tasks you need to identify, but also you have to decide you have to identify how well do we want people to learn this. And I'll just refer you back to a notion of what was published as Bloom's taxonomy. So Bloom recognized six levels of learning, the first one being just simply to recognize. So if I can recognize it, I may look at the picture, I don't quite know what it is, but I can recognize it and I can recognize it again. That's the lowest level of learning. The next level is to define. So I would be able to define what that is that I'm looking at. Then you get these upper levels of learning where people can not only define, but they can also analyze, they can pass higher levels of judgment, and then they can synthesize and create new things on the go, on the moment's notice, at the drop of a hat. That's the kind of upper level learning that we're really seeking when we're asking people to be flexible in an austere and dangerous environment where people can get killed and more people can die tomorrow as a result of these decisions. That by itself, that level of learning, those upper three levels of Bloom's taxonomy, they don't apply well to the classroom online instruction. You really do have to exhibit competency and be able to not only do analysis, but write papers and show your exhibit, your competency in decision-making when people give you scenarios for decision-making. And so that by itself also doesn't meet just exactly one-to-one with exercises. Drills and exercises work well on the first and up through third levels. But when you get this higher level of learning, that's when we need to start thinking about a tiered approach. And then finally, let's look at what the manager needs to know and what the technician needs to know, or even among managers, that lower level supervisor, the middle level supervisor, and what the executive needs to know. What we found in our studies was that the majority of the decisions that were made by those upper level executives, and this isn't surprising, were actually business decisions. They were administrative managerial decisions regarding human resources, regarding planning, leadership, those kinds of things. Whereas the middle and the lower level managers were the ones that were sort of balancing technical versus managerial skills. So once again, you know, summarize for this, I think professionalization has to recognize a career ladder. It has to recognize a tiered approach of learning that addresses that career ladder. And we also have to think about the individual pieces of those careers, whether they be management or technical mixes.
Joe, you could certainly relate to this. What are your thoughts? That was just so much good stuff. My head is spinning. I have to listen to this podcast to get to grasp all of this. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I think Mark is spot on. You know, I mean, what he's speaking to there is experiential learning. And, you know, I think it's so difficult in the disaster world for the reasons that we've talked about before. They're episodic and often far between, and it's very challenging to have folks participate in more than one or two in their entire career. And they just simply never reach a point where they get close to those upper levels of learning, or if they do make it up in the hierarchy, they tend to be in very narrowly focused fields. And that, you know, in many cases just simply limits their capability from a very broad perspective. So Mark is spot on with where he's going with that. One of the things I have been really pleased to see in the FEMA USAR world in the last few years is sort of this development of a task book that new folks, as they come into a position, basically have a little book, and they record their experiential stuff, and those, you know, as they work in sort of deputy positions, and their seniors look over their book and sign off that they've gained some competencies here and some experience there, et cetera, so that we have a better way to sort of officially know what those people know and what they don't know. And I think also that's a great data source for the other thing that Mark was talking about, which is, you know, these jobs often are very broad based and are not only in my case, not only medicine, but are, you know, people management and logistics and operations and communications and knowing how to rappel down a building and get in and out of a helicopter safely, and you know, a million other tasks that we never really think much of, and we certainly don't tend to think of people needing such a broad skill set in those environments. But I think Mark summed it up absolutely beautifully.
Well, and of course, experiential learning is exactly what you guys do at Paragon. So you certainly not only appreciate that concept, but you exercise it. So, you know, more power to you. I mean, it's exactly what you're talking about. Don't just talk about it, live it. So what do you think, Jamie?
Well,
good stuff, huh?
Yeah, this has been a great episode, and I think that as we kind of close out this one, I think we need to reserve the opportunity and option to maybe have Mark back on again and talk some more about this, because I think this is just right up our alley. And like you said, you know, what Joe and the guys at Paragon Medical Education Group do to bring their experiential training to people, I think is probably one of the reasons they're utilized so well by many organizations around the country, is because they do bring that level of competency type training with instructors who have been involved in multiple disasters and can speak to the experience they learned and then pass some of that knowledge and competency on to their the people they're instructing. And Joe, if people want to look at what they can do to bring Paragon into their organization and their community to do this type of training, where can they reach out to you?
Well, they can certainly find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. We have a Facebook page under the same name. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, and you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
And we do want to thank you again, as always, for being our ongoing sponsor here. If you guys like the Disaster Podcast, you should definitely stop over at their website and at ParagonMedicalGroup.com and let them know that you appreciate their support of the show, and check out their resources. So, Joe, thanks again for doing that.
Our pleasure. We absolutely enjoy it.
And Mark, where can folks find you? Give us a little bit of insight into your website and what kind of things they might find there.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for that. You can find our website at disasterdoc.org, O-R-G, And there you can find a couple of different items with it at the website in particular. Up at the top, you'll find menus for the Academy, which is our online training programs. Much of them focus on the public health emergency side, so relatively a nice complement to the medical EMS and nursing side of those things. And then also provided as well, key up on top of the homepage, are the Disaster Doc Archives. So that's actually a free set of publications, my own publications in regarding terrorism, natural disasters, man-made disasters, and so on, as well as some book chapters, and just general access to many of the other kinds of free things that we have. For example, like we have ongoing blog and also a new ebook as well. But also, I just want to give just take this opportunity as well to thank you folks. So this has been a very interesting thing for me, and I know that I've been a big fan of Joe's work, and just hearing more about the podcast here, I just love the idea. I think that, the way of the future, our education is going to be in the palm of our hands 24/7. You guys are leading the way. So fantastic job, and I'm happy to be a part of that.
Well, and if you're active on Facebook at all, we'd love to have you come over and check out our Facebook group for the Disaster Podcast. Just search Disaster Podcast and ask to join the group. We'd love to have you in. We're building a nice little community of emergency responders and disaster responders over there.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, as a matter of fact, if I may, I'd like to go ahead and plug the Disaster Risk Reduction for Health discussion group that I manage on LinkedIn as well. It has over has about, I think it's about now, about 5,000 members. And we discuss those ideas of how do you prevent yourself from ever being the disaster victim? How do you protect your health? How do you not be injured in the first place at the individual level and also at the societal international level? So everyone's welcome for that discussion as well on LinkedIn. Just take a look at Disaster Risk Reduction for Health.
All right, great. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes for this episode as well, so people can click on that and find it directly. Thank you. Sam, where can folks find you?
Hiding under the desk. I feel so small all of a sudden listening to Mark and his level of expertise and everything he's done. And of course, everything Joe does. It's like, I'm just a little medic here doing my thing. Anyway, you can find me in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley, Sam Bradley 11, on the Facebook site, and most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com, where there's another opportunity for any of you to come up. Let us know what you think about this episode. Let us know what you'd like us to talk about. We're definitely going to get Mark back. I think, this is the tip of the proverbial iceberg in terms of his knowledge, and we definitely want to pick that brain some more. So we're going to do that. How about you, Jamie?
Well, everybody can always find me over in any social media circle under the handle PodMedic. So check me out over on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, any of those places. We'd love to connect with you there. And, of course, over in our Facebook group and over at DisasterPodcast.com, where we love to get comments on any of the episodes. You can just scroll down to the bottom, click the comments link, and leave a comment there. If you have a question for Mark or Joe or myself or Sam for this episode or any of the other episodes and those guests, just leave a comment there and we'll get back in touch with Mark, and either he can leave a comment directly or we can copy and paste his comment in reply to yours. But we will get an answer for you if you have any comments or questions. So please take an opportunity and do that. And Sam, I think one of the things that Mark's outlined here, especially with the competency required to effectively manage and treat people in the midst of disasters, it always brings us back to the same way we closed the podcast. And this has been underlined, I think, quite effectively in this episode.
Oh, absolutely. And I totally agree with that, not just in disaster medicine, but in all levels of education, especially medical education. But it clearly makes the point. Austere medicine is not our everyday medicine.